It is not Good Friday, it is Palm Sunday. And I'm glad that we reflected on that so I don't have to, because it is a little weird. The energy of those 2 days are a bit different. One is called, one marks what we call the triumphal reentry. And then a week later, you're celebrating the resurrection of Jesus on the day of Easter. What we might call a triumphal reentry, maybe. But Good Friday is it's the day of mourning in between two celebrations. And some people become confused at the notion that we can call Friday good. How can we call a day marked by such suffering good? I think it's particularly hard to wrap our heads around because we don't experience our own suffering as good most of the time. Maybe in retrospect, but almost never when it's happening. And I find that Good Friday taps, at least for me, it taps into the idea of grief in a really potent way. I think about all Jesus's friends and loved ones, his mother, losing this person who meant the world to them. I don't think they would have called it good on that day. And maybe there are some of us who can process their grief in a very sort of orderly way and can call the process good the whole time and just be very present and be very grateful for the time you got to spend with that person. That's never how I've experienced grief. It's always much messier than that. It's always much more painful than that. Honestly, it's awful. I hate losing people. It's my least favorite feeling in the world. And so it left me wrestling with the idea of what made Friday so good. And that's largely what I'll be talking about this morning, because I do think it is. I don't disagree with the idea that what happened on that Good Friday was a necessary moment and a very good plan to restore relationship between God and humanity. So how is it good? How can we call suffering and loss good? For me, as I said, sometimes only in retrospect can I realize that ultimately the grief you experience is the love you had for that person, lacking the object to put that love on. But that love is certainly good. But what's good about Good Friday? It's the idea that God in human form laid down his life to free us from the powers of sin, death, and destruction. But I can't help but wonder, is there another way we can call this day good with its loss and its pain? So, I'm going to reflect on the cross, but I will spend a little bit of time moving through some of the other events during Holy Week or during what we also call Passion Week, some that we have already referenced and reflected on through the act of communion. In fact, I'm going to talk, not at length, but I'm going to talk some about communion. And if I would have thought to, I'd have asked the rest of the team to serve communion today. That was just a happy little accident. We'll call it a God thing. So I want to talk a little bit about that grief that was experienced on Good Friday. I think it's especially important for us as American Christians to be confronted with this idea of grief, because I feel like in the West, in the United States in particular, we really have an anemic grief process. We don't really allow ourselves the time and the space to sit in our grief, allow it, sort of feel through it, give it space enough to really healthfully process it, because it just doesn't fit into how we do work and life and culture and society. We just don't have space for grief. In fact, I experienced probably, and I'm very blessed in this regard, my first major loss of somebody I cared about deeply happened in my early to mid-20s when my grandmother passed away. And it really, really rocked my world. I had spent as much time with my grandparents growing up as I did with my own mom. And so it was like a parent dying. It was cataclysmic. And I was so over busy during that time of my life. I had two full-time jobs and a part-time job, which the math doesn't math, but maybe it only does if you're in your early 20s. And I just didn't have time. I had too many, I was also a volunteer Young Life leader, which is essentially a third part-time job. And there was no time. There was no time. I had too many plates spinning. I got to take exactly one bereavement day off from all of my jobs, just a Monday, and then back to work. Because if I wasn't going to do the work, who was going to do the work, right? And I think that's how we treat grief in the United States, is it can't become an obstacle to our productivity. It cannot get in the way of yielding the product that is expected of us to be good members of society. And so instead of allowing myself the time and space I needed to grieve properly, I grieved a lot for a day and then had sort of a protracted grief experience in little bursts, frankly, for years. And that's how it happens. It's sort of like if you don't take a sick day off from work, power through, you're going to be a little sick for months. That's definitely how it works for me. Maybe I need to see a doctor. But I want to call out that it doesn't have to be this way. There are different traditions and cultures all over the world who even today have a very different experience around grief. For example, in Judaism, there's a tradition called sitting Shiva, where for an entire week, the recently deceased, their entire family and community goes to their home to just sit together for a week to cry and to grieve and to share stories of the recently lost. It's a deeply powerful experience to grieve not just alone and not just for a short period of time, but in a community, and to take the time you need to do it. In fact, in Hindu culture, they do something similar, but it actually, I believe it, let me check on this here. They do it for, I've lost my place. Longer. which is interesting, 12 days, I found out. But that's not how we do it here. We do one funeral, one wake, and one bereavement day, of course. Which is so interesting to me because it seems to me as Christians, we would be even more attuned to the nature and value of grief than our friends from other faith traditions. After all, few religions can boast that the centerpiece of their faith is the humiliation and death of their God via public government-sanctioned torture and murder. Like, that should be an idea that we're comfortable with, that death is a part of life. And even our God didn't exempt himself from that. So in light of that insight, I believe Good Friday is a recognition of God's presence with us, not just in our grief, but in all of our suffering. For it said that on that day, on that cross, Jesus suffered all grief, pain, and separation, such that he was crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I'll take some time to process that radical idea that Jesus would say that in his dying moments in just a moment. Because I think ultimately what makes Good Friday important is if we jump too quickly from Palm Sunday to Easter Sunday, as I believe some churches and traditions I've been a part of tend to do, they don't want to linger too much on the hard, on the painful. But if we don't slow down to meditate on the fact that our faith requires an element of suffering, I believe we're missing something significant. Death is as vital a part of our salvation story as resurrection is. We can't have new life without death first. Jesus said it over and over. We can't have restoration without pain first. We can't have hope without suffering. And the hope you find on the other side of suffering is a much more robust kind of hope. I believe that's something that is essential to our faith tradition, is when we say hope, we don't mean a cheap kind of positivity in the face of suffering. We mean a hope that recognizes that there is pain and suffering that must be dealt with in order to experience a kind of harder won hope on the other side. And ultimately, I believe Good Friday is a really beautiful reminder for us that even in this world, which in so many ways still feels so steeped in loss and pain and disconnection and death, that the God who created us did not exempt himself from all those things, and that he is with us today. So usually when I talk about Good Friday, I try not to rush to talking about resurrection. But I do think there's something unique about this year, at least in my own life, but I also believe in our little corner of the world that I don't know if it would be appropriate for me to gratuitously wallow in this idea of suffering without pointing toward next Sunday and toward the idea of resurrection. I don't want to linger too much on pain without hope, and I will get there. But first, I think we need to reflect on the death that made all the new life we can experience today possible. So, as we know, Good Friday recognizes Jesus' death on the cross, but it's also a culminating event for what we've called this morning Holy Week or Passion Week. And what's really interesting, and I didn't know this, maybe everybody knows this, I didn't really grow up in the church, so I found out some of these things later. Passion doesn't really, in this context, refer to Jesus' passion for us in that, you know, we have passion for our friends, passion for our hobbies. Passion literally means, its root means, to suffer. Passion means suffering. Just as compassion, where we get the word compassion, is to suffer with someone. To have compassion is to share in their suffering. But passion in this context means the suffering of Jesus. And just as when Jesus died on the cross to share in, and in fact, shoulder our suffering, that's the kind of passion or compassion that was experienced by Jesus. So there are two stories from this week I want to address before bringing it back around to Good Friday, and one has already been made mention of this morning, but I want to take a kind of unique angle of approach to look at it. I want to look again at that moment from Passion Week when Jesus met with all of his closest friends to share a meal, what would be his last meal. We call it the Last Supper. It took place in the second story of a building just sort of on the edge of Jerusalem. It's called the Upper Room. It's said to be above the gravesite of King David. And this meal, it has this sort of this sense of grief attached to it, this sense of loss, this sense of betrayal. It's also really precious. If you think about it as a man in his 30s sharing his last meal with all of his closest friends, really with his family. Jesus spent so much more time with his disciples than he did with his family during the last 3 years of his life. So if you think about this experience, this scene, as just a man and his closest friends, that enables us to look at it through a fresh lens. Because I think here, Jesus is inviting us or reminding us to hold our friendships close through the very end of our life, which again, and I'm going to say this a few times today, I don't want anybody to think I'm picking on American culture, but sometimes it's helpful for us to take a step back and realize that the way we do things is not the way things have always been done all over the world. Because I love my country, I don't have any desire to live anywhere else, but some people do it differently, and some of our habits, I think, can get in the way of us living our healthiest lives. In the United States, particularly, say, post-1950s, we have a model of living that is a very recent invention, the nuclear family model, which is not bad at all. There's nothing wrong with mom, dad, 2.5 kids, white picket fence, little doggy, nothing wrong with it at all. But virtually every other culture throughout history has had a more communal style of living, multi-generational families living in the same home, and living in neighborhoods, living with friends. It's just a much more communal style of living than the individualistic one we experience in the United States. There's a joke, I've heard it a number of times, and it's funny, but I think it's also really poignant, is that Jesus's most impressive miracle was having 12 friends in his 30s. And I feel vindicated by that. As a single man who is 33 years old, with a lot of friends who I consider to be family, because that's who I spend my closest time with. They've been there for me in my hardest times. This is also an idea certain communities experience more poignantly, maybe, than other communities. For example, one of my jobs that I currently do, because I guess I'm addicted to having too many jobs, is I work part-time for a nonprofit that supports homeless teens in Eugene, and we're expanding services into Springfield as well. Youth who live on the street find family amongst one another because they often were rejected from their families or their parents are in and out of prison. And there's a lot of overlap between that community and another community where found family is kind of the norm, which is the LGBTQ plus community, who, again, often have been kicked out of their homes by virtue of their identity and have to find a different kind of family. But I think this should also resonate with us as Christian believers, for what is a church if not a found family, right? We don't have to live this kind of siloed, like, I get married and my friends don't see me again until I die. Maybe on Sundays. That's not what church is. That's not what the early church was. It was genuinely a communal style of living together. So in any case, this dinner we call the Last Supper introduced a ritual that we practiced this morning, which again, that was lucky. I didn't plan for that. That would have required any more amount of planning and communication than I did, which is about all I have time for. Again, too many jobs. But this ritual, this sacrament of communion, or the Last Supper, or some traditions call it the Eucharist. Not everyone knows this, but prior to the 1500s and the Reformation, and even among different traditions all over the world that are less rooted in evangelicalism, the sermon isn't the centerpiece of the church service in most traditions until really the last few hundred years. Communion was the centerpiece of the worship service. That's why we met together as communities. There were messages, there were sermons, there were people delivering ways to interpret and apply scripture in new ways and lift up the community in that way. But more than anything, we were called together to meet and to eat and to remember. To meet, eat, and remember what Jesus did for us. That's one of the most fundamental ideas in the Christian faith. And we already, Gene shared what we remember when we recite the words to reflect on what communion means, what communion signifies in terms of what Jesus did for us. That he took the bread, broke it, gave thanks, said, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, he took the cup, saying, "This is the cup of the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." When I was in seminary, I worked at a church, in fact, a Presbyterian church, which is very funny if you know me. Not a Presbyterian bone in my body, really. But something that's really interesting about that tradition, and a lot of more what you'd call mainline traditions, essentially non-evangelical Protestant churches, is they retain an element of ritual that I think is actually appropriate for recognizing the weight of something like communion. Like, you have to memorize the word, they call them the words of institution, the take this bread, take this cup. You have to memorize it because they treat the communion act as a holy experience. And I believe we do as well. But for them, part of expressing that means like learning the ritual and doing it right. And I sort of chafe against that as somebody who grew up in a more charismatic evangelical tradition, because we instead value personal connection and relationship and authenticity. Like, we don't want to create too many barriers to access the Lord's table. But I also think there's something too, like, these are words that have been said for thousands of years. This is how we usher in the communion experience for our church. And I think that's a way of recognizing that that's maybe the most important thing we're doing here. Maybe it's not what I have to say up front. That's the most important reason to get together as a church. Because I am literally, and I cannot emphasize this enough, just a guy. I'm just a guy. Like, do not believe something because, I say this to my students all the time too, don't believe something just because I said it. Like, who am I? I've studied a lot. I care a lot about these things. I think on my best day, God may be able to speak through some of the things that I say up here. But it's not true because I say it. I try and say it because it's true, if that makes sense. And I just wanted to share that insight around communion, because I think we maybe underemphasize its importance a little bit. And especially, there's something about communion that represents, and Jean said this as well this morning, like God becoming present with us in a new and tangible way. In different traditions, they literally believe that Jesus essentially becomes bread and wine for us. Literally is probably not the right word, but it's certainly not just remembering. In the Catholic Church, they believe there is a spiritual, metaphysical transformation of the communion elements where we are, in a very serious, non-literal, but kind of literal way, eating and drinking of Jesus. And I find that really beautiful. Like, I don't literally believe it to that extent, but Jesus becoming present with us in something as normal as food, I find it incredibly beautiful. And again, during this time of my life where I felt depression over having lost my grandmother, I was working at a church, one of the three and a half jobs, and nothing else about church was connecting with me at that point. In a real and tangible way, I didn't hear a word that the pastor preached that broke through that sort of fog of depression and grief I was experiencing. I didn't experience any level of emotional connection with God through worship. But there was something about communion where it sort of bypassed my logic, it bypassed my reason, and just sort of met me in my body. Because God was tangible, God was physical. I didn't have to think too hard about it. And for some of us, when church doesn't feel like it means a lot to you or what it usually does to you, pray on the idea that maybe there's one element of what we do together on Sundays that might catch you off guard, that might surprise you in how God shows up for you. Because I think it's not incidental that the ritual of communion met me in my grief, because it's also a reflection on Jesus' body broken and Jesus' blood poured out. It, in a very real and intense way, is not just a reminder, but an experience, maybe a co-suffering with what Jesus did for us on that day. It's a reminder that the world is messed up and there's so much pain. There's so much loss. There's so much grief and disconnection. But God understands that pain because God experienced that pain, which ultimately is the idea that I want to share with you about Good Friday, is the moment we remember of communion, the God on a cross. I believe it is Christianity's best answer to a timeless philosophical question that has plagued humanity essentially for as long as we've been around, which is, if we were created by a good God, why is the world so less than the goodness of God? Why is there this profound disconnection between the good God and the world that God made? Philosophers and theologians, they call it the problem of evil, and they call any attempt to reconcile these two ideas, good God, bad world, they call that process theodicy, coming from the Latin words for God and justice. If God, how not justice, essentially, is the question of theodicy. And there are a number of ideas that have been posed over the centuries, even by Christian theologians. Some will cite the idea that free will requires us the ability to not choose God, and our act of not choosing God creates a world in which bad things happen. And I don't think that's a bad answer, but ultimately, I don't think it's a very satisfying one, because that can maybe account for the ways in which we hurt each other, but it doesn't necessarily account for all the other ways in which the world is broken, right? That doesn't, to me, sound like or feel like a satisfying answer to why do some kids get cancer? Why do earthquakes happen? Like, I don't know that the problem of human sin totally accounts for all the ways in which we experience pain and suffering in the world. Although if you ask John Wesley, who is one of my favorite theologians from the last few hundred years, he would say that sin is what broke the world to that degree. We just live in a fallen world because of the choice humanity made. Again, I don't think that's necessarily satisfying, but to complicate the idea a little bit, I'd invite us to recognize that there are actually ways in which human behavior impacts the world around us, right? We know, or there are credible studies over the last couple decades to suggest that our behavior is impacting our environment and is even making worse certain natural disasters that do happen. We've been seeing more hurricanes. We've been seeing more wildfires. There are tangible ways in which our behavior impacts, like, animal populations going extinct. But ultimately, I don't think that's satisfying to an individual in their suffering, at least not as much as what I think is Christianity's best answer to the question of theodicy, which is the God hanging on the cross. Because we can be sure, if we take the biblical account at face value, that our God understands our suffering. That may not explain it away, but I think maybe it's even more meaningful than that. Because when I hear Jesus on the cross crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? I just so identify with him in that moment. It gives me permission to feel that way sometimes. Because, like, if anybody had the right to know or a reason to know that things were gonna be okay, you'd think it was Jesus. You'd think he saw the big picture in some way, maybe not every detail, given that he was fully human, but he was also fully divine. If anybody should trust the goodness of the Father's plan, you'd think it would be Jesus, and even him is crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? We read it in Matthew chapter 27. He records this moment. From noon to three in the afternoon darkness, or from noon until three in the afternoon, darkness came all over the land. About three in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that's why I believe that the crucifixion of God in the person of Jesus is the best, most orthodox answer, orthodox meaning aligned with our traditions, what we've always believed. I think it's the best and most orthodox answer to the problem of evil because it's not a logical proof, because it's not a philosophical argument. It's a bleeding man dying who inexplicably claimed to be the God of the universe, sharing his life with blue-collar workers and fishermen and sex workers and government officials, even sometimes religious fundamentalists, a little bit. They didn't always like what he had to say. But I'm influenced in my view of the crucifixion by a 20th century German theologian named Jürgen Moltmann, who believed that Christianity is the religion of the crucified God. And any behavior, any church ritual, any practice, or any teaching that forgets that Christianity is the religion of the crucified God ceases to be Christian. And this means really something, I believe, fundamental about what it means to be Christian, because we worship and model our lives after a God whose methods of conquering evil and sin and death is dying on a cross. It means that Jesus wins by losing. Jesus brings life through death. And that's not the kind of power we see modeled for us in the world. We see power modeled with an iron fist. We see power modeled through domination and bullying. That's not a Christian expression of power. Not if the cross is true. Instead, the God whose kingdom power is expressed not through acts of domination, but through acts of vulnerability and love. That God's love is not a power over us, but in fact a power coming up from under us to catch us when we fall. Up from the grave. Jesus' death and resurrection are good news. And Friday is a good day because it reminds us that our God is deeply good. Because the death of Jesus is the condemnation of the systems of violence and scapegoating that would lead humanity to put its God on a cross. It shames and scandalizes a world that functions that way. It shames and scandalizes power structures that exist through violence and domination. I mean, it's ultimately just God's love for us, is this willingness to lay down his life for us. It's a full love on display, a kind of self-emptying, egoless love that we can't even really reckon with the scope of. We can't even really wrap our tiny heads around this kind of love. But what we can do is recognize that this is our God and how lucky we are. How lucky we are to worship and to connect with and to live in and through this God who models love through suffering and who shows that goodness is lived out through acts of love and service. And ultimately, this love reminds us in the context of the full salvation story that while we may suffer, particularly for others, suffering never has the final word. And that's me pointing forward to next Sunday. I don't want to leave you guys to sit in the pain for a week. I think suffering never has the final word. And that's why Friday is good. Thank you that you enter the city not on a war horse but a donkey. Thank you that for that last week of time you spent on earth before your death and resurrection, you were constantly demonstrating vulnerability. You were constantly submitting yourself into suffering for us. Thank you that you subvert what power means in this broken world and call us to do the same. I pray that you'd be with us during this week in our most profound suffering, in our fear for the world. I pray that you would be a source of stability and guidance, and that you would bring us together a week from now to celebrate. We thank you for all these things, and in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, amen.